Hi everyone, welcome back to Hands-Free Studying for the MBE with Brainscape. Today's video is about civil procedure, so get ready. And let's get started with our first set of cards covering jurisdiction and venue. Question 1. Define subject matter jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction is the power for the court to hear a particular dispute based upon the dispute's subject matter. Question 2. What are the three types of subject matter jurisdiction? The first is federal question jurisdiction, the second is diversity jurisdiction, and the third is supplemental jurisdiction. Question 3. Define federal question jurisdiction. Federal question jurisdiction gives federal courts jurisdiction over all claims arising under the Constitution, federal laws, or treaties. And this is found in 28 U.S.C. 1331. Question 4. What are the elements of federal question jurisdiction? The first, there's a federal question in dispute, and second, that question appears on the face of a well-pleaded complaint. Question 5. What is the well-pleaded complaint rule? The well-pleaded complaint rule holds that a plaintiff must state that a defendant has already violated a federal law on the face of the complaint to qualify as federal question jurisdiction. Now note, the plaintiff cannot anticipate that the defendant will violate a federal question in the future. That violation must have already occurred to satisfy the well-pleaded complaint rule and qualify as federal question jurisdiction. Question 6. What is diversity jurisdiction and when does it exist? Diversity jurisdiction is jurisdiction based on the party's citizenship, and it exists when 1. There is complete diversity between the parties, which means that no party is a citizen of the same state as the other party, and 2. The amount in controversy is greater than $75,000, and this is from 28 U.S.C. section 1332. Question 7. How is citizenship for diversity jurisdiction determined for 1. Persons and 2. For corporations? Persons are considered citizens of the state in which they are domiciled, which is where they currently reside and intend to remain indefinitely. Now remember, only one domicile is allowed, meaning you can only be a citizen of one state at a time. Now for corporations, they're considered citizens of the state where the company is incorporated and or where they maintain their principal place of business. Now, unlike people, corporations can be citizens of two different states at the same time. Question 8. Where is a corporation's principal place of business? A corporation's principal place of business is the place where the corporation's high-level officers direct, control, and coordinate the corporation's activities, in other words, the brain or nerve center of the company. Typically, this is the corporate headquarters, but it does not need to be. Question 9. True or false? In a suit between a party and a corporation, the party must be diverse from both the corporation's place of incorporation and its principal place of business to satisfy the requirements for diversity jurisdiction. True. Complete diversity between the place of incorporation and the principal place of business must exist to satisfy diversity. Question 10. An unincorporated association is a citizen of which state? An unincorporated association is a citizen of every state where its members are citizens. These upcoming questions are related to the civil procedure topics on Erie and injunctions. Let's get started. Question 1. What is the Erie Doctrine? The Erie Doctrine mandates that when there is diversity jurisdiction, federal courts must apply state substantive law and federal procedural law. Question 2. What law applies when there is federal question jurisdiction? Federal laws. Now remember that the Erie Doctrine only applies in diversity jurisdiction cases, not in federal question jurisdiction cases. Question 3. What's the difference between procedural and substantive law? Procedural laws are laws that define the process by which a case will progress. Substantive laws are laws that provide a right. Now, some laws, such as statutes of limitations, fall in a gray area between the two, and this is where most issues with Erie will come up. Question 4. In diversity jurisdiction cases, assuming that state common law and federal law conflict, what is the first step in the Erie analysis? The first step is to determine the law behind the primary issue and determine whether that law is procedural, substantive, or something in the middle. So if the issue is substantive, apply state law. If the law is procedural, apply federal law. And if the law is something in the middle, then proceed to step 2, which is the next card. Question 5. For Erie analysis, if the law is neither substantive nor procedural, meaning something in the middle, how do you determine which law to apply? There are 3 different tests that you can use. First, the outcome determinative test. Second, the forum shopping test. And third, the balance of interest test. First, for the outcome determinative test, ask, does the choice of law impact the outcome of the case? If so, apply state law. Second, for the forum shopping test, ask, would failing to apply the state law lead more people to want to litigate in federal court? In other words, encourage forum shopping. If yes, then apply state law. And third, for the balance of interest test, ask, does the state have a greater interest in having its own law applied than the federal law? And if so, apply state law. Question 6. Generally, for what types of rules will the balance of interest fall in favor of the state, also referred to as strong state policy rules? These are generally remitter, additer, notice of claim requirements, and issue preclusion rules. Question 7. As a general rule, are choice of law rules substantive or procedural? Substantive. Question 8. As a general rule, are statutes of limitations substantive or procedural? Substantive. Question 9. As a general rule, are elements of a crime or case substantive or procedural? Substantive. Question 10. As a general rule, are burdens of proof substantive or procedural? Substantive. These upcoming questions are related to the civil procedure topics on pleadings and parties. Let's get started. Question 1. What is a complaint and what must it contain? A complaint is the pleading filed to initiate a lawsuit. It must contain 3 things: the grounds for subject matter jurisdiction, the statement of claim, and also the demand for relief, meaning the damages or equitable relief sought. And this is found in Rule 8A. Question 2. What must the statement of claim contain? It must contain a short and plain statement showing that the plaintiff has a plausible claim for relief. And this is in Rule 8A2. Question 3. What sort of claims need to be pled with particularity? claims involving fraud, mistake, or special damages. And this is from Rule 9. Question 4. The defendant has blank number of days after service of process to file an answer. 21. And that is from Rule 12A. Question 5. What must an answer contain? An answer must contain an admittance or denial of all complaint allegations. Failure to deny all of the allegations constitutes an admission. An answer must also contain any affirmative defenses. If the defendant fails to raise them in the answer, they will be waived. And there are 6 affirmative defenses that need to be raised in the answer. The first is self-defense, then statute of frauds, statute of limitation, contributory negligence, claim preclusion, and fraud. You're doing awesome. Let's take a quick study break to remind you that it's important to space your studies over time. A little bit every day, starting very early, is way better than cramming at the end. Now, let's get back to questions 6 through 10. Question 6. What is the effect if a party pleads lack of information because they don't know whether or not an allegation is true? This will be treated as a denial. Question 7. What are the Rule 12B grounds for dismissal? There are 7. 1. Lack of subject matter jurisdiction. 2. Lack of personal jurisdiction. 3. Improper venue. 4. Insufficient process. 5. Insufficient service of process. 6. Failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. And 7. Failure to join a party under Rule 19. And these are in Rule 12B. Question 8. What is the deadline for filing 12B motions if responsive pleading is allowed? Before the answer. Question 9. What is a 12B6 motion and what is the deadline for filing it? A 12B6 motion is a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. The court reviews the plaintiff's complaint only, no other evidence, to determine whether or not to grant the motion. And this must be filed before the defendant files their answer. Question 10. What is a 12C motion and what is the deadline for filing? A 12C motion is a motion for judgment on the pleadings. The court reviews all of the pleadings when deciding whether or not to grant the motion. It must be filed after the defendant files their answer. These upcoming questions are related to the civil procedure topic, discovery. Let's get started. Question 1. What is discovery, and what are the 2 main categories? Discovery is the process for parties to obtain information from each other and third parties. The 2 main categories are mandatory disclosures and requests for information. Question 2. What are the 3 mandatory disclosures and the deadline for each? The 3 mandatory disclosures are 1. Initial disclosures, 2. Expert testimony, and 3. Pre-trial disclosures. Unless otherwise ordered by the court, the deadline for initial disclosures is 14 days after the discovery conference. The deadline for expert testimony is 90 days before trial. And lastly, the deadline for pre-trial disclosures is 30 days before trial. Question 3. What are the 6 methods of discovery? 1. Mandatory disclosures. 2. Interrogatories. 3. Requests for admissions. 4. Requests for documents and tangible items. 5. Requests for mental or physical examinations. And 6. Depositions. Question 4. What type of information is discoverable? Unless otherwise limited by the court, discoverable information is any information that is 1. Relevant to the case, 2. Proportional to the needs of the case, and 3. Not privileged. And this is from Rule 26(b)(1). Question 5. What type of information is not discoverable? Any information that is either irrelevant, privileged, or work product, unless there's a showing of substantial need or undue hardship. And this is found in Rule 26(b)(1). Question 6. When is information considered relevant for discovery purposes? Information is relevant if it is more likely to make any fact in the dispute more or less likely to be true, regardless of whether it is admissible. Question 7. What is a Rule 26F conference? A Rule 26F conference initiates the discovery process. It requires that parties meet as soon as practicable to 1. Discuss the claims and defenses, and 2. Discuss the possibility for settlement. If no settlement is reached, then the parties must develop a discovery plan and submit that to the court within 14 days. And this is from Rule 26F. Question 8. What is the deadline to hold a Rule 26F conference? At least 21 days before the scheduling conference is held. And this is Rule 16B. Question number 9. Within 14 days of the Rule 26F conference, what initial disclosures do parties need to make? Parties need to disclose 1. Any contact information for individuals who are likely to have discoverable information. 2. Documents that support a party's claims or defenses. 3. Damages calculations and any material upon which this calculation is based. And 4. Insurance agreements that could satisfy all or part of a possible judgment. And this is from Rule 26F2. Question 10. What is a Rule 16B conference? And by when must this conference occur? A Rule 16B conference is a conference where the judge issues a scheduling order that details the deadlines for disclosures, filings, and other discovery issues. And this is from Rule 16A. The deadline for a Rule 16 conference is as soon as is practicable, but this must be within 90 days of the defendant being served, or within 60 days of when the defendant appears, whichever is earlier. And this is from Rule 16(b)(2). These upcoming questions are related to civil procedure pretrial adjudication concepts. Let's get started. Question 1. What does it mean if a case is dismissed with prejudice and without prejudice? If a case is dismissed with prejudice, it's considered an adjudication on the merits and you cannot relitigate. If a case is dismissed without prejudice, then there has been no adjudication on the merits and you can relitigate. Question 2. When may a plaintiff voluntarily dismiss an action without a court order? A plaintiff can voluntarily dismiss without a court order by one of two ways, either filing a notice of dismissal before the opposing party serves either an answer or a motion for summary judgment, whichever comes first, or by a stipulation of dismissal signed by all parties who have appeared. And this is governed by Rule 41A(1A). Question 3. Can a plaintiff relitigate a claim after dismissal if the claim was dismissed by a court order or stipulation, by the plaintiff herself, by settlement? 1. A plaintiff can relitigate a claim after dismissal by a court order or stipulation because it's considered without prejudice. 2, a plaintiff can relitigate a claim after dismissal by the plaintiff herself because it's considered without prejudice unless it's the plaintiff's second dismissal on the claim, which is then considered to be dismissed with prejudice. And 3, a plaintiff cannot relitigate a claim after dismissal if the claim was dismissed by settlement because that's considered to be dismissed with prejudice. Question 4. What is an involuntary dismissal under Rule 41B? An involuntary dismissal under Rule 41B is when the defendant seeks to dismiss the action because the plaintiff has violated the rules or a court order. This is governed by Rule 41B. Question 5. An involuntary dismissal under Rule 41B is considered with or without prejudice. The correct answer is an involuntary dismissal under Rule 41B is considered with prejudice. And let's take a quick study break to remind you to drink plenty of water. Remember that your brain is so much better able to learn and retain knowledge when it's fully hydrated. So take a big sip
and let's get ready for the next 5 questions.
Question 6. What is a default under Rule 55A? A default under Rule 55A occurs when the defendant fails to timely respond to the complaint, which is usually within 21 days of service or 60 days after waiver. Now note, this is not the same as a default judgment, which is when the court enters the default into the record. Question 7. What is a default judgment under Rule 55B? A default judgment under Rule 55B is a judgment on the record that the defendant defaulted. Question 8. What is the difference between a default and a default judgment? A default is the defendant's failure to respond, which is stage 1 in the process. And a default judgment is a judgment entered into the record after the defendant has defaulted, or stage 2. Question 9. When can the court clerk enter a default judgment? The court clerk can enter a default judgment if the plaintiff shows 5 things. That the defendant was properly served, that the deadline to respond has expired, the defendant failed to respond, the defendant is not a minor or incompetent, and 5, that the sum owed is certain, and this is shown by affidavit. Question 10. What can the plaintiff do if the sum of damages is uncertain when seeking a default judgment? The plaintiff can seek a default judgment from the court, and the judge will then hold a hearing to determine the damages. Now note, the court clerk cannot enter a default judgment if the damages are uncertain. This must be done by a judge only.
These upcoming questions are related to the civil procedure topic on jury trials. Let's get started. Question 1. When does a party have a right to a jury trial? Federal Rule 38, and also the 7th Amendment, guarantees parties have the right to a jury trial in all civil actions. Now, remember that this right only exists for claims under law, not those under equity. Question 2. If both legal and equitable relief is sought, does the right to a jury still exist? Yes, the right to a jury exists, but only for the non-equitable claims, meaning the claims for damages. Question 3. How could a party demand a jury trial? First, file a written demand within 14 days after the last pleading, and second, properly serve that written demand to the other parties. And this is from Rule 38B. Question 4. Does a party need to re-demand a jury trial if the case is removed to federal court? No, as long as the jury trial was properly demanded initially. And this is Rule 81C3. Question 5. Does failure to properly serve and file the demand for a jury trial constitute a waiver of that right? Yes, a party waives their right to a jury trial unless its demand is properly served and filed. And this is Rule 38D. Question 6. How many jurors are required to form a jury? 6 to 12 members. Each juror must also participate in the verdict unless they are excused under Rule 47C. Question 7. Do jury verdicts need to be unanimous? Yes. Jury verdicts must be unanimous and returned by a jury of at least 6 members, unless stipulated otherwise. And this is from Rule 48B. Question 8. Define voir dire, also known as voir dire. The process by which jurors are selected. Question 9. What are challenges for cause, and how many does each side have? Challenges for cause are used to dismiss a potential juror due to bias, and there's an unlimited number per side. Question 10. What are peremptory challenges? Peremptory challenges allow a party to dismiss a juror for any reason, as long as that reason is race and gender neutral. And this is in Rule 47B. These upcoming questions are related to the civil procedure topics, appeals, and preclusion. All right, let's get started. Question 1. What is the deadline to file a notice of appeal? A notice of appeal must be filed within 30 days of the final judgment or order being appealed. However, if the United States or federal agency is a party, that deadline is extended to 60 days. And this is found in Federal Rule 4A. Question 2. Which courts can hear appeals from the district courts? The Federal Courts of Appeal. Question 3. Define the final judgment rule. The final judgment rule states that appeals courts can only hear cases with a final judgment on the merits of the entire case. In other words, there's nothing left for the court to address. There is an exception. The appeals court can hear cases without a final judgment if there is a basis for an interlocutory appeal. Question 4. Define interlocutory orders. Orders issued during litigation that are not final. And this is from 28 U.S.C. Section 1292. Question 5. Define an interlocutory appeal. An interlocutory appeal is the appeal of an interlocutory order. Now, these are rarely granted because interlocutory orders are not final. Some interlocutory orders are appealable as a matter of right, for example, the denial of class certification, while others are only appealable pursuant to analysis under the collateral order doctrine. Question 6. What interlocutory orders are appealable as a matter of right? Injunctive orders, orders appointing or refusing to appoint a receiver, orders directing the sale or disposal of property, patent orders that are final except for accounting, and orders denying arbitration. Question 7. Can a district court order an interlocutory appeal? Yes, the judge may do so in a written order that states, 1. That the order being appealed involves a controlling question of law, 2. That there is a substantial ground for difference of opinion, and 3. That the decision on appeal could help bring about the end of litigation. Question 8. The collateral order doctrine permits a party to appeal an interlocutory order if what 3 conditions are met? If the order, 1. Conclusively determines the disputed question, 2. resolves an important issue that is completely separate from the merits, and three, is effectively unreviewable on appeal from a final judgment. Now note, the collateral order doctrine is extremely narrow and rare, and has only been applied to cases involving immunity and double jeopardy. Question 9. When are class certifications appealable? Class certifications are appealable within 14 days following the district court's decision to grant or deny certification. And the Court of Appeals has full discretion whether or not to grant the appeal. And this is found in Rule 23F. Question 10. What is a writ of mandamus? A writ of mandamus gives the appeals court authority to review lower court decisions for abuse of judicial authority. They can be granted if, 1. The petitioner has clear and indisputable right to relief, 2. No alternative route to desired relief exists, and 3. The writ is proper under the circumstances. Remember, this is an extraordinary measure that is extremely rare. And that's the end of our MBE Civil Procedure hands-free study round. To reach full mastery, remember to study in Brainscape. Our mobile and web app uses the latest in spaced repetition techniques, allowing you to optimize your study time and track your progress down to the finest detail. Of course, when you're driving, cooking, exercising, or otherwise unable to navigate the app, be sure to keep listening to the rest of this hands-free studying playlist. No matter what subject you're learning and what method you're studying it, Brainscape helps you rise to your challenge.